Our first case for this morning is United States against Saeed Ayesh. Ms. Babich.
We have to lift this a little. So up.
It goes either way. There's a button on the side. They'll help you.
There we go.
Ah! I want it to stop.
There we go. Good morning, Your Honors. Linda Babich appearing on behalf of the appellant defendant Saeed Ayesh. We're requesting that the sentence in this case be remanded based upon the district court's abuse of discretion in issuing an above guideline range sentence of 35 months, 1 month below the statutory maximum for international kidnapping. The reasons we're asking for the remand in this case in particular is that the factors under 3553A, which the district court indicated in aggravation as aggravating factors, were not sufficient to warrant a sentence of 35 months. In addition, given the cases nationwide, it creates a disparity in the sentences of similarly situated defendants.
But it was only 5 months above the top of the guideline range, right?
It was, Your Honor, but in this case it was significant, in particular given the cases that represent international kidnapping nationwide. Most of the argument that I wanted to focus on was on those particular cases. When you look at this case, it generally fits into what I would call the heartland of cases. There's nothing in this case that would have warranted a sentence of 35 months.
But the court was looking at Mr. Ayesh's history as well. I mean, this is a multi-factor decision, as you well know.
Certainly. And our position isn't that he didn't look at the 3553A factors. It's that, you know, the judge did look at them in a fashion but didn't analyze them in a way that would have warranted. For example, everything that was considered by the judge in aggravation was really already considered by the sentencing guidelines. For example, you discussed his history. The only history that really existed here was a criminal history of a domestic battery. What the judge considered was a history of arrests, which the sentencing guidelines, while instructive here, indicate that cannot be considered in order to elevate his history.
Wasn't he really looking at the conduct underlying the arrests?
But
the 3553A1 factor allows you to consider the history and characteristics of the defendant, which would be broader than the guidelines would allow.
Certainly, and I was not the attorney there handling that, but I'm going to. He looked at the conduct, but I would say that the conduct is unsupported or unsubstantiated. In particular, arrests can't go to substantiate or to support a history of abuse when the cases were either dropped or he was never given an opportunity to challenge.
But the conduct of the individual, even if conviction doesn't result, is something that's relevant for the sentencing judge, isn't that right?
I would argue no, it's not, because they are unproven and they are not corroborated. At this juncture say that they're akin to hearsay. I understand that.
How can you say that if even acquitted conduct can be taken into account by a sentencing judge?
I think they can be taken into account, but also should it be not weighed as heavily as this judge certainly did. I mean, this judge basically indicated this was a pattern of abuse almost akin to an actual criminal history. I mean, the fact that he elevated it based upon this criminal history to 1 month below the maximum certainly was not warranted. The history would go to the deterrence factor, which was also accounted for in the sentencing guidelines, and he did receive increases already under the guidelines as a result of his history and other deterrence factors. I mean, for example, when the court was considering aggravating factors, he received an increase in his sentence for the planning of this case. He received, under 2J1.2B3C, he received a two-level increase. For his role in the offense, he received a two-level increase under 3B1.1C. The deterrence factor with respect to the vulnerable child, he received a two-level increase.
But for us, the standard of review is really just the question, was 35 months an unreasonable sentence for the district court to choose? We are not the district court. And it's hard for me to see, in light of everything in this record, what it is that Judge Drahegan may have done that would warrant us calling it an unreasonable sentence.
Well, I would certainly look at the cases nationwide. While the government indicated that there is...
We don't know how similar they are. I mean, that's where you have to get back into the factors that Judge Tinder was talking about.
But I think if you look at the cases nationwide, I mean, and I think in this particular case where it is international parental kidnapping, where there are so few cases, one case does make such a difference. I mean, with respect to the... cases that we did compare, while the government says there were similarities, there weren't. I mean, in each and every case that the district court issued a maximum sentence or close to maximum sentence, there was the defendant there did not return the child. The defendant was gone for periods of 18 months. If you look at Fazal, Tomsakovich, and one additional case, that they left the country for significant periods of time.
But this guy just got caught. He was about to take the child to a country with which the United States doesn't even have a treaty.
I understand, but to say that there is what would happen thereafter should not be considered, just as it was fortuitous for Mr. Ayesh that he was caught. It would also be speculation that shouldn't be considered as to what would have happened had he left.
But there's not speculation. I mean, if we have a treaty relationship with somebody, then there's a structure and a way that these things are done. It's not speculative that there's no treaty. There is no treaty. It's not speculative that the law of a different country might have different presumptions about whether the father or the mother ought to have custody of a child.
It is speculative as to what Mr. Ayesh would have done. There's no telling whether he would have had a change of mind. It's speculative as to how long he would have been gone.
As persistent as he was putting this together, that a change of mind was very unlikely. He spent several years in the United States, didn't he?
But I don't think we can base a sentence based upon what he would have done thereafter. I think we must look at what had happened up to the point. He was caught. He was cooperative at that point. The child was unharmed. I believe that...
Now, your comparison to other cases, I'm a little confused by this. Are you saying that the lowest sentence given for parental kidnapping becomes the maximum that should be given?
No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that the maximum should be reserved for those cases that have aggravating factors that would warrant a sentence at that end. I don't believe that this case warrants a sentence at that high end. I believe this fits into what I've sort of labeled the heartland of international kidnapping cases. Certainly what he did was not likable, but it doesn't warrant a sentence of 35 months. I mean, in each and every case that the sentence was issued toward the maximum, there were significant aggravating factors. It should be noted here that he had acceptance of responsibility. In every other case that the defendant received a maximum of 35 months or 36 months, they had obstruction of justice. There was no obstruction of justice charge here. He had actually received acceptance of responsibility pursuant to a plea. What's interesting, too, to note is the original plea. I mean, the government's point to argue at this point that this sentence would not be reasonable is sort of belied by the original plea agreement. What was originally in the plea agreement that would have been reasonable was a sentence of 12 to 18 months. I mean, in light of what was originally contemplated by both the government and the defendant in this case, it does become extreme, a sentence that is 35 months, that it appears only 5 months over the guidelines, but it is something that is, in this instance, extreme.
This would not be the first case I've seen, though, where at one point along the way the government is prepared to accept a lower sentence, the district court chooses something higher, and then the government defends that sentence. It's often the case that there are a number of different sentences, each of which might be reasonable.
Certainly, then they're entitled to that position, but our position would be that a sentence at that end would be unreasonable. I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harjani.
May it please the Court, Sunil Harjani for the United States. Your Honors, defendant Saeed Ayesh was sentenced to 35 months imprisonment for international parental kidnapping, as you've heard. The guidelines range are not in dispute and are not that far off, 24 to 30 months. The district court's reasoning was not an abuse of discretion because it was supported by the 3553A factors. And in particular, defendant has asked what was the aggravating factors, and it's plain from the record that there were here. First, the district court considered that the defendant had made numerous threats to harm the child, to harm the child's mother, and to harm the mother's family. Those were addressed by the district court, and something that is not considered in the guidelines, threats by the defendant to cause physical harm to the child and the mother's family and the mother. Secondly, there was also the fact that the child suffered mental harm, the district court heard that the child suffered nightmares. The child was fearful that the defendant would come back and try to take her away again. Third, the district court considered the deterrence factor here, something which is not explicitly considered in the guidelines. And
that would be true in almost any international parental kidnapping case, for that matter.
Certainly, deterrence is always should always be considered, and it's true in that circumstance. But here we had a child who was 2 years old, so a child that the defendant could come back and take again because she was so young, had no means really to defend herself. On top of which, the nature of the defendant's act, so calculated and planned, and his consistent threats prior to the kidnapping to take the child away.
What was the evidence supporting the idea that he was threatening everybody? Was that something the probation officer found, or was that something brought out in the hearing?
It was brought out at the hearing by the child's mother. The child's mother testified and told the district court about that. And particularly, finishing my point, Your Honor, about how the defendant had threatened to take the child away on numerous, numerous occasions from her. That was why the court found deterrence to be a particularly important point in this matter.
What about the arrests? I mean, the district court seems to have taken the view that, in a sense, where there's smoke, there's fire. If he's been arrested all these times, then some of the conduct that was alleged to have taken place must have taken place.
Your Honor, as certainly one of Your Honors noted, the consideration by the district court under history and characteristics is wide and broad, both statutory and also by this circuit's precedent and case law. It's important to note that for one of these acts, the mistreatment of women, in fact, working as an air conditioner man specifically, going into customers' homes and then groping them and fondling them, there was actually one conviction for that, and that's plain in the sentencing record, the court pointed out. There were two other arrests for similar conduct. And again, the district court noted it wasn't weighted heavily. It was sort of a one line in the record where the court said, I recognize these also exhibited this type of conduct in prior arrest. It wasn't dealt with in an absolute terms. It was considered to evaluate whether or not the mother faced potential harm again from the defendant. And because of his conduct in these situations, combined with the threats of the mother, the court concluded that the character of the defendant showed that he had the potential to harm the mother. That's where that conduct underlying the arrest fit in. It wasn't absolute. It was an evaluation of his character on whether he could harm the mother again. And that's why the district court considered it. And certainly under 3553A, the government submits that's entirely appropriate in evaluating the type of defendant that's before the district court.
Isn't there some language in our cases about requiring a compelling justification if there's to be a sentence above a guideline range?
Yes, Your Honor. It seems that there is, I would say, somewhat of a conflict of decisions. There are cases that talk about a compelling justification. However, the circuit's decision in the Bartlett case talked about how some of those cases, the Gooden case, the Wachovia case, seem not to have survived the Supreme Court's decision in Nelson, and how the cases seem to be moving to a place where compelling justification are no longer needed. That is, since there's no presumption of a guideline sentence in the district court, there should be then no need to have a compelling justification to deviate from that sentence.
But some justification is needed, correct?
Your Honor, it is certainly, in reality, a district court is going to discuss why it is it's imposing a deviation from the guidelines. What the Bartlett court decision suggested was there was no need to, in fact, that the district court, all the district court needs to do is discuss the reasonableness of its sentence that it is imposing. I note that in this case, it doesn't matter. Either way, the sentence is supportable. But certainly in the government's brief, we felt an obligation to point out that Bartlett seemed to be moving away from the compelling justification standard of review. And once again, the aggravating factors here warrant the sentence imposed. I would like to make one point about the nationwide disparity the defendant brought up. It's important to note that those cases that we all cited, none of them discuss the reasons for the sentence imposed. We sort of gleaned from them the fact when they're discussing other issues, what sentence was imposed in that particular case. So we don't know really why any of these courts imposed the sentence they did. But as for the Heartland argument, there are three cases which have imposed a statutory max. Each case is different. Certainly they can't be compared. Some of them are apples and oranges. But taking it as a whole, in the totality of circumstances of the 3553A factors, disparity being just one of them, combining that as a whole, the sentence cannot be determined an abuse of discretion. If there's nothing further, Your Honor, the government asks you to affirm the sentence. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further?
I'd like to briefly address the Bartlett case and the compelling justification standard. The Bartlett case was issued in May of this year. On that same date, and I would say that the Bartlett case actually stands for the proposition that the judge's task is to issue a reasonable sentence. The judge is not to start with the presumption of the guideline range being reasonable. However, the court there said that there must be a correlation ultimately between the guideline range and the ultimate sentence, which permits the compelling justification standard to survive. Bartlett also stood for the proposition that that the district court need not provide analysis necessarily of why the guideline range itself would be insufficient, but again, that there must be some correlation between the actual sentence and the sentencing guidelines. There were three decisions, one issued U.S. v. Hatcher on the same date, U.S. v. Miller issued on July 30th, and U.S. v. Presbytero on June 24th, that again reiterate that the standard for analyzing above guideline range sentence should look at the 3553 factors and also indicate whether there is a compelling justification for the above guideline range sentence. With respect to the last statements made by the government regarding the nationwide disparity, I do believe that when looking at the sentences, it's clear why those cases do fall at the high end of the spectrum and why this case is different. I would say that the factors really in analyzing them included things such as the acceptance of responsibility, the failure to cooperate, and things that just simply did not exist here. We're asking that this court find that there was an abuse of discretion and remand this matter for further sentencing. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.